It is good to be with you tonight at Estes. We have looked forward to this so much. You know, Tracy and I, when we were in college, this was our Wednesday night church. I was preaching most Sundays, and oftentimes it was back where I grew up, and so we'd be back there for the weekends, and then on Wednesday night we would be here. And it brings back a lot of good memories and just a feeling of home to come and to be with you tonight. I know in our midst are a lot of folks that Fried Hardeman has been a big part of your life, and you have been a big part of Fried Hardeman's existence also. I just look around the room, and I see faculty and staff and administration. I know that there are many that have attended Fried Hardeman, your parents, your children, your grandchildren, and it really is pretty awesome to be at a place that has meant so much to Fried Hardeman. You have made a huge investment in your life and made a big difference there, and we thank you for that. I think also about the fact that the difference that you as a congregation have made in the lives of Fried Hardeman. Obviously, we come to Fried Hardeman as students, and a vital part of our lives as Christians is to have a congregation to study the Bible with, to worship with, to, you think about all the one another passages in Scripture, to have a congregation to love, to be loved by, and to stir each other up to good works. And you have done that over and over, year after year, for so many years. And around us are many college students that their lives right now is a testimony to that. You give them a place not only to worship, but a place to serve if they so choose. And I hope they do so choose. And it really is amazing. Also, through the years, whether it be to the Bible department or to sponsor the annual lectureship, as a congregation, you continue to be a supporter of Fried Hardeman in the spiritual work that takes place there. And we sincerely thank you for doing that. Tonight, one of the things that we want to do as we are dismissed, and by the way, if you will be turning to 2 Timothy in just a moment, we're going to look at some verses out of 2 Timothy, the first chapter. But one of the things we want to do before we leave tonight is we just want to connect with you and just visit with you. If we don't know you, get to know you. If we do know you, just to visit and reconnect again. And if by chance there's someone here that has questions about Fried Hardeman, there are a lot of us on the trek here from either the admissions department or advancement, and we would love to just visit with you and answer any questions that you might would have. I know that you may be a parent of a high school student, and there may be some questions on your mind because that's where you are at this time in your life. Well, we're here, and we would love to answer those questions tonight. But anything we can do to just connect with you. We found out a good way to connect. You learn this in Scripture, actually. A good way to connect with people is to put something in their mouth that tastes good. And so when we started dreaming up the idea of the treks, we just thought about what are some foods that every time you hand it to somebody, they smile. Well, that was real simple. You give someone an iced down glass bottle Coca-Cola, and they always smile. I don't know why it happens. It does. They just always smile. So tonight we have Coca-Cola's, the little glass bottle ones, iced down for everybody here. So before you leave, you'll see what we call the Mick. Just find the Mick. I'm not even for sure if it's here or in the back, but it's out front. So just pass by, know that there's a Coca-Cola for you, and hope you enjoy that. I also know that not every one of you is going to smile. I'm not naive. I wasn't born yesterday. Some of you are hard sale. So what we brought for you guys is a moon pie, and you get to pick your flavor. And maybe a Coke and a moon pie will make you smile. Although I've had several to walk up to me and say, you know, it's supposed to be an RC and a moon pie. I can't please everybody, okay? But if a Coke and a moon pie would make you smile, there's many, M-A-N-Y, and there's many, M-I-N-I, moon pies out there. So pick your flavor and enjoy those. And of course, thanks to so many of you in the congregation, we pull all the corks out, and here's our final offer. If you're really hard-hearted and crusted and it's really hard to make you smile, we have bacon on a stick for you tonight. And I'm amazed at the people who say, I've never had bacon on a stick. Well, that can come to an end tonight, and you're going to be glad that it comes to an end tonight. The response we regularly get from that is, while someone is chewing with their mouth full, they'll say, I think that's the best thing I've ever had in my mouth. It really is delicious. So be sure and grab you a bacon on a stick. Also, the Mick will be set up tonight as a little photo booth. So if you'd like to take home a little postcard of you and anybody that you want to cram inside the mic, you can do your crazy poses that you like, and then you can take it and put it on your mirror, whatever you want to do to remember tonight. But we are really, really thankful to be with you tonight. I was a student at Fried Hardeman University, and I was doing a summer internship. And during that summer internship, I was staying at a family's home. They were very faithful Christians. We were having breakfast, at least the two sons that were still at home. A few sons were already grown. And one was on each end of the table. One was 13, one was 17. Both of them were over 6 foot tall. They were just huge, strong, athletic boys. Both of them played football and would go on to be very successful in collegiate football. And one even played NFL football. And the mom is still in the kitchen, still trying to make more breakfast for those consumers of the breakfast. And I was just there kind of getting my breakfast ready. At that time, the phone rung. And the conversation was kind of odd. She didn't really speak in complete sentences. It was more like one of those conversations where it's like, what? Who? When? Now, where did you say? And then the phone call ended. And she looked in the direction of her sons, but kind of past them. And she said, your brother Dustin is dead. And one boy dropped his utensil out of his mouth. And both kind of chimed in together saying, what? And she said, your brother died. And so then came the inquiries. What? When? What happened? Where? And then she said, he died spiritually. Oh, very loudly, they rebuked their mother. Mom, you can't do things like that. Why would you scare us like that? Because, you see, they had had a teenage brother to die physically. And they knew that experience. And so they were strongly rebuking her for doing that. And she looked at them just as firmly, and she said, as they were saying, you shouldn't have told us he's dead. And she looked them back, this time in the eyes, and she said, he is dead. He's dead spiritually. She's probably one of the greatest women of faith I've ever met. I knew her very well, and so later on, when the timing just seemed like it would be okay, I said to her, I said, you know, you mentioned that he's dead. And I know that you also have buried a son who died physically but was very strong spiritually. And now you're seeing a son die spiritually. And so I asked, I said, which one is the hardest to experience? And she said, oh, by far, it's harder to watch my son die spiritually. Because I know how well off my son, who's physically dead, is because he was so strong spiritually. Isn't it interesting how easy it is for us to ignore reality? You see, it's hard to ignore the reality of physical death because it's before our eyes. And we somewhat have to accept it in that sense. But spiritual death, it's easy to pretend that it doesn't exist. It's easy to pretend that maybe there's even a third option or a fourth option. But think about it for a moment. Even in the Lord's Sermon on the Mount, he made it very clear that there's only two paths. And each of those paths have their own separate destination. So as we think about like this very moment, I don't mean eternally like when the judgment day comes, but this very moment, everybody in this room, we are either alive or dead spiritually. No one here is on some kind of gray path. Well, they're kind of alive spiritually, but they're not really. We're either alive or dead. When we think about that, we think about ourselves as a church, the Lord's church. And you know, there's a 12-month period of time that is the hardest period of time for the Lord's church. It's that period of time that begins graduation night of high school and over the next 12 months. If the studies and the statistics are anywhere close to true, it's during that 12-month period of time that we see about half of our young people die spiritually. And when we think about it that way, it's staggering, it's heartbreaking, and it should leave us saying, well, what could we do to change that? And I know that many of us in this room have spent days and weeks and months and years of our lives trying to figure out how to address that. But also the reality is that oftentimes we have responses that are to two extremes. One extreme might be something like this. Well, when I run into a 19-year-old and they've moved away, I just don't ask how they're doing spiritually. I don't ask, where are you going to church now? Because I know that most of the time, they're not going to be going anywhere. They've left the Lord. They graduated from high school and the Lord, and they're living a different kind of life now. And so I began stepping on my feet, my toes. How many times have I talked to a 19, 20, 21-year-old, and I've asked them about their college, I've asked them about what they're doing, I've asked them about everything except intentionally not asking them anything spiritually because I didn't want to hear the answer. Now you tell me, what kind of good does it do me as a brother and sister of theirs to sweep that topic under the rug and pretend like it doesn't happen? But then there's also the other extreme. Some believe that the answer is, well, let's just cater everything in our existence. So now this generation, we don't know exactly what label is going to land, but right now a lot of them are calling Generation Z. You know, the millennials are beyond college age now. And so the 19, 20-year-olds now, some are calling Generation Z. And so the idea would be, let's study Generation Z. How's your mind operate? What makes you respond? How do you think? What could we do that would appeal to you and to appease you? And so let's, as a church family, just take everything we do and let's do it for this one generation. And if you think about it, you see churches that all they do is cater to one generation. And any time a church marries one generation, they become a widow to the next and to every other generation. And when you really stop to think about it, if you have to go worship with everybody that's your age, you've missed the whole concept of church. The church is God's family. And since the very beginning of time, we see the very design of family is generational. When we look at our own physical families, if we're healthy, functional families, we have individuals in our family that are grandparent age. We have those that are parent age and even younger parent age. And we have those that are teenagers and those that are young children. And that would be the description, if you will, of a full or of a healthy family. And then when you think about it, what about God's family? By very design that God gave, not us, we didn't design it. By God's design, the church ought to always have those who are grandparent age, those who are parent and young parent and young adults and teenagers and children. And the key for our spiritual livelihood is that we encourage each other and we serve each other and we help each other keep our eyes on the Lord and we walk hand in hand together. We can't do it alone. Our college age, they can't do it alone. But truthfully, our older folks can't do it alone. We all need each other. It's a part of God's design. And so tonight, I want us to look at an example, and where does time go? And I want us to, in this very short looking at this example in 2 Timothy, the example of Paul and Timothy will not fit perfectly in everybody's life here. In other words, not everybody here is either an older man or a younger man. But in this, I want you to see the principles. And I want you to find the application for your life to say, what kind of mistake do I make? Now, are you listening to me, young people, and are you listening to me, older people? What kind of mistake do I make if the only people I ever reach out to are those my age? Like, that's not the design of God's family. We ought to be reaching out to those older than us. We ought to be reaching out to those younger than us. And yes, we should have peers that we reach out to also. But by the design of family, we ought to always be moving out of our comfort zone to form genuine relationship with those who are older and younger. And someone says, why? For this simple reason. We need it to live spiritually. We can make a difference in each other's lives. There can be less young people dying spiritually if there's more people engaged in their life who are not flesh and blood. If there's more people engaged in their life who are the spiritual family that will continue to walk with them during that time. So when we look at 2 Timothy, you'll notice in the first chapter and in the first verse, Paul identifies himself as the author of this. And then who he's writing to in verse 2, he says, to Timothy, a beloved son, grace, mercy, and peace from God the Father and Christ Jesus our Lord. I thank God whom I serve with a pure conscience as my forefathers did, as without ceasing. I remember you in my prayers night and day. Let's pause that. No, let's do one more. Greatly desiring to see you, being mindful of your tears, that I may be filled with joy. What kind of relationship did Paul have with Timothy if you're just reading this right here? He calls him a son. But we know from reading other passages, he's not the father of Timothy. The relationship where back in Acts the 16th chapter, he might have met him as early as Acts 14, we don't know for sure. But Acts 16, Paul at this time would have met a young man. Probably today what we would say was in Generation Z. He meets a young man for the first time. You know what he could have had? He could have had the mindset that says, oh, it's a good kid there. But in their mind, I don't know if we really think it this way, but let's just say by actions you think it this way. And it would be this simple. But I don't form close relationships with people who's not my age. That'd be weird. Oh, I'm on an important mission trip, but I don't ask young people to help me with ministry. If I fix the Lord's Supper every Sunday, it's only going to be me and people my age. I'm not going to ask someone young to come, and I'm not going to help them learn how to minister also. If I teach the 4-year-old class, I'll do it myself, or I'll ask somebody close to my age to help me. I'm not going to ask a young person. What about if instead we kind of held our feet to the fire and said, I'm going to spend the rest of my life making sure that I have relationships with people that are younger and they're going to be real. Listen, there's nothing wrong with like a simple, hey, I want to write you a note and I want to encourage you and it be a one-time thing. That's good. But what I'm suggesting to you tonight is that should not be the extent of our relationship with young people. You can't have a genuine relationship with hundreds of people. Really, it's hard to have a genuine relationship with probably 20 or 30 people. But what if right now you picked out an 8th grader, 9th grader, 10th grader, 11th grader, 12th grader? What if you picked out a freshman in college, a sophomore, a junior, senior? And what if you thought, you know, I just want to reach out to them. And I want to try to form a real relationship with them. And what if it became such a strong mentoring relationship that it was like a father, son, a mother, daughter? And then notice, he didn't just say son there, did he? He said beloved. Loved well. Loved much. This relationship that we formed. Now keep in mind, There was a day where he was a stranger. Oh, his name is Timothy? You guys at Lystra are real impressed with him? I want him to go on this mission trip with me. Now we fast forward a lot of years. And now we're toward the end of Paul's life. And how has that relationship blossomed? When he refers to him there, how does he refer to him? Or not a description of him. I'm talking about the relationship. Did you notice he said, I pray for you night and day? Not flesh and blood. Not in the same generation. When's the last time you have known someone 20 or 30 years younger than you so well that's not your flesh and blood that you pray for them night and day? My guess is Timothy probably prayed for Paul a lot. When's the last time you've had someone that's not your flesh and blood that's 30 or 40 years older than you that you've prayed for every day? But notice, the reason he said he could do that is because he said that I remember you. This young man was constantly on his mind. And not only was he on his mind, but did you notice at the beginning of verse 4, when he said, greatly desiring to see you? He really looked forward to the next time he would see him. One of the times that I was trying to understand this topic, I decided that I wanted to do a real informal survey. When I say survey, I just mean to help me learn, not to create statistics or something. And I did a real informal survey with probably 15 or 20 young people that I knew grew up at Mount Juliet, and they were away at college. And I asked them questions about what makes it harder for you to live a spiritual life now during this time of transition. Now, this particular girl that I'm about to tell you what she said attended Fried Hardeman, and she said, when I come back to this congregation, talking about Mount Juliet, she said, I was born here. She said, I grew up here. And when I come back, no one even asked me, like, how's school going? Or how are you doing? She said, it's almost like I never left, or either no one even noticed that I left. Do you hear what she's saying? College is a huge transition in your life. I want those of us that are older, you just imagine some kind of major transition in your life. And then imagine no one in your church family ever acknowledging it. You say, how could that happen? Well, I can tell you this. If there were more of us that prayed night and day for each other, because they were regularly on our mind, our memory, and we were greatly desiring to see them. You see the point right there? What if there would have been some older people in that congregation that would have looked over and seen her and said, I've been wanting to see you. How's school going? You know what? I've been praying for you every day. Can you imagine the difference that would have made for her? Now, you see what? I want to make sure we're real clear on this. I am not suggesting, let's make a to-do list here. Okay, I need to remember to pray for somebody every day. I need to remember somebody every day. I need to remember some way to look forward. If that's what you think that this is saying, I've mistaught it. What I want you to see is that when the relationship is real, these things naturally happen. What if we reach out to form real relationships with people that are not in our generation, where it would be natural for us to pray for them, it'd be natural for us to remember them, it'd be natural for us to desire to see them? I want you to notice three other things in 3 minutes that's very important. Look at verse 5. It wasn't only a genuine relationship, but it also was a genuine faith that Paul wanted to help Timothy have vibrant in his life. See in verse 5, Paul says, when I called remembrance the genuine faith that's in you, which dwelt first in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice. Notice this wording here. And Paul says, I am persuaded is in you also. Now, if you read the next 4 or 5 verses, what is insinuated is that Paul thinks Timothy is having a little bit of fear factor here. And when you read verse 8, probably the reason was because Timothy knows that Paul is being held in a dungeon for preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ, and he's waiting to be executed. And wait a minute, I'm a young preacher, Timothy's probably thinking, of the gospel of Jesus Christ. If he's about to die for being a preacher of the gospel of Jesus Christ, how long is it going to be before I'm going to be dying because I'm a preacher of Jesus? Maybe I don't want to be known as a follower of Jesus. Maybe I don't want to be known as a gospel preacher. I don't know how strong that was, but there must have been a little bit of that happening here because of the next few verses and the way they're addressed. So with that in mind, I want you to think how powerful this is of what Paul does here. And I want to remind you that peer-to-peer we could do this, but it can't be done with the same power when it's someone older, though it's like a father or mother figure to someone younger. And you see what he did there? He says, I know your mother. I know your grandmother. And I know the genuine faith they have. And notice he didn't say, I want you to be persuaded. He said, and son, I want to tell you what I'm persuaded. I'm persuaded that you have that same kind of faith in you. There's something powerful when someone that you've looked up to, that they have invested in your life and that relationship is real, and they can look down to you at a difficult time in your life when you might naturally be thinking, I'm giving up. Or you might naturally be thinking, I can't do this. I want to do it, but I can't do it. And then you have someone that you've looked up to that you have valued so much, and they look down at you and say, I want to tell you what I'm persuaded. I'm persuaded you can do this, young man. And then the next verse, he talks about the service that he wanted to rekindle within him. Look in verse 6. Therefore, I remind you to stir up the gift of God which is in you through the laying on of my hands. Our younger generation, they have servant's heart, but they still need those that are older to not only believe in them, but to help provide opportunities. To provide opportunities and fan that flame, to rekindle that spirit. But then notice the final thing he says there, final for what we will do tonight in verse 7. For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. Fear is paralyzing. Timothy was probably wrestling with that at that time. The next verse talks about the suffering that Paul invites him to be willing to take part in the suffering that he was suffering. And you can imagine that probably Timothy's looking at that and he might be a little bit hesitant right now because fear is paralyzing him. And so Paul, in the way that a father-like figure could do, in a sense says, son, you tell me where that came from. Everything in our life has a source. Was it from God or was it from evil? He says, son, that fear that you're experiencing right now, it wasn't from God. But let me tell you what God will do for you. God will give you power to overcome what you're wrestling with right now. God will give you love. And love is one of the most powerful factors about our faith. And God also give you a sound mind. Have you ever noticed that when you're really afraid, and I don't know if you're like this, but this is what I find about myself. When I am really afraid, I start to say things like this. I just don't know. I'm just not certain. And what does he say to that young man that's afraid? He says, God will give you a sober mind. God will give you clear thinking. Don't lean upon you. Paul would say, don't lean upon me. The power's from God. The love's from God. The sound mind is from God. I want to believe that this relationship that was even stirred more through this letter probably changed Timothy's life as he was reminded of a genuine relationship where he was being challenged in genuine faith to rekindle genuine service so that he could practice his faith with genuine courage. We need each other to be reminded of the most important things. Tonight we are about to sing a song that literally, don't hear this as a cliche. Hear it as a description. We're going to sing a song of encouragement. Brothers and sisters here are going to sing a song encouraging any of us that may need to make changes in our life. Maybe fear has stopped us. Maybe our faith hasn't been so genuine. Maybe if we're honest with ourselves right now, we are spiritually dead. But as long as there's physical life, there's the invitation of grace. There's the opportunity of redemption and pardon. And don't let fear, because where would that come from? Don't let fear stop you tonight, but instead allow the power and the love and the clear thinking that God would bring to you to do what you need to do. If you've never become a child of God, why not be baptized into Christ tonight? If you have become a child of God and yet you've strayed and you know you're not spiritually alive, don't leave here tonight dead. That's serious. Leave here tonight redeemed, alive. If we can help in any way, come as we stand, as we sing.